I'm Josh Cooperman, and this is another installment of Convo by Design Presents West Edge Wednesday, a look back at all of the incredible programming from the 2023 edition of the West Edge Design Fair held at the Barker Hangar in Santa Monica, California. These conversations were held on the stage designed by Marve Designs and presented by BR Home. This is it. This is part 10 in our series from the West Edge Design Fair. Southern California has long been a place where adventurous creatives of all disciplines would come to create with other like-minded dreamers, where a designer could draft and see their masterpiece come to life only to realize, wasn't quite right. Shake it out like a giant etch-a-sketch and start again. Now, in a post-pandemic world, it is incumbent upon that very spirit for a new generation of creatives to address and overcome the seemingly endless barrage of challenges. And they will, because that's what they do. This conversation features individuals who are doing just that. Band Design's Sarah Malik Barney, Christine Vroom of Christine Vroom Interiors, and the legendary Leo Marmol of Marmol Radziner. This panel could only be moderated by one person I know, and that is the incomparable Francis Anderton. Thank you to Convo by Design partners and sponsors Thermosol, Moya Living, and Design Hardware for making the podcast possible. And thank you for listening and watching these episodes of the show. For links to all our partners, guests in this episode, West Edge Design Fair, Marbella, BR Home, please check the podcast show notes for links, and you can find that at convobydesign.com and click on the podcast tab. Thanks for watching and listening. Here's Francis.
Well, thank you so much, Josh.
Okay, so this is how we're getting started. Leo says, is there a way to quiet the front of house? Bless your heart, man. If you can tell me how to figure that out, I would have done it 2 days ago. Oh, just go ask them. Yeah, let me go do that.
We'll wait for you, Josh.
Wait for me.
Or maybe we could talk about architectural and design solutions since we have three very creative people on the stage. So yeah, hello everybody. My name is Frances Anderton. I've been following design and architecture in Los Angeles for more than 30 years since I became one of the many people who moved here from another place, absolutely drawn by LA's creativity. And so obviously it's very interesting for me to talk about this very topic. All roads lead to SoCal, long live the creative experiment. I'm actually going to put a question mark at the end of that because I think we're at a very interesting time right now where the question might be, do all roads still lead to SoCal as a place to thrive creatively? And that's what we're going to talk about now. I think what you will hear amplified from the guests is that LA is an incredible magnet for creatives, to the point that we're now at a kind of interesting stage in LA's evolution where it's actually, one can no longer come here as the impoverished artist and find a warehouse for 5,000 square feet that costs, you know, almost nothing and start experimenting. It's less easy to forge that path in Los Angeles. So what does it mean to be creative and to develop one's creativity in Los Angeles today? It, of course, is still happening. It's still sort of hypercharged, but sort of what form that takes is what we'll talk about. And I'm very excited to be joined by three luminaries here in the field, an architect and two interior designers. And I have to say, I am so lacking in technical abilities that I managed to break the printer this morning, and so I'm trying to read everything off of my phone, which Apple designed such that the screen keeps going black, you know? Can anyone change that thing where the screen keeps going black? So anyway, here I am with Sarah Malik Barney with Band Design, Leo Marmol, architect with Marmol and Radziner, and Christine Vroom with her eponymous firm, Christine Vroom Interiors. The way we're going to do this is each is going to briefly introduce themselves as images of their work rolls by. Can we cue the images? And then after that, we will talk for 30 minutes or so, and then I'm going to open the floor to questions. So let's turn immediately to my left, to Sarah. Tell us about yourself, Sarah, and your work.
Hi. So I'm Sarah. I'm the founder and principal designer at Band Design. Our firm is actually headquartered in Austin, Texas, but I've been asked to give my bio as it relates to Southern California. So here we go. So my family moved to Austin when I was 8 years old, so I call it home. And I have family in San Diego, and we came to visit when I was maybe, let's say, 10 years old. And I remember we drove up to LA to do all the Hollywood things, and we drove past the UCLA campus through Westwood and then through Hollywood, and I just thought, what is this magical place, and why doesn't everybody want to be here? And I also grew up with two parents who complained about their jobs constantly, and I thought, why does anybody work in an industry or a job that they don't love? So immediately I decided at 10 years old I was going to move the second I could to Los Angeles and work in the entertainment industry. And that's what I did. After college, I packed up my car and I drove out, and I worked for many years, all through my 20s in LA, in the entertainment space, in TV production, and as a talent agent. And then decided, I can't raise kids in LA. That seems weird. So went back to Austin in 2009 when the economy was really terrible and nobody knew up from down, and stayed in entertainment. And then when 2016 hit, I thought, I can't do this anymore. I love entertainment, I love working in this space, but my heart's not in it anymore. And that's when I went back to school for design and launched my firm. I thought it would be a fun, like, goofy thing that I just did on weekends. I didn't think it was a real job. And then within a month, I had to quit my full-time job and hire my first employee. And now we're 160 homes deep, and we actually just opened an LA office. So after 7 years back in Austin, or no, sorry, 14 years back in Austin, I forget what year we're in, I thought, I really miss LA, and I would be making excuses to come back all the time. So just for a change of pace, we up and moved the whole family 4 months ago. And so now here we are with both offices in Austin and Los Angeles. So that's sort of my spiel of my love for California. It always has my heart, always has. So I'm happy to be back.
But interesting that you are between the two places, and we'll talk more about Correct. That in a moment. But yes. I did just a very quick question. What were your parents' jobs?
Oh, God. I think my mom was like a secretary at a cable company, and my dad was a civil engineer in oil and gas.
Okay.
I mean, it was the 90s, too. So, like, people just worked to work, and they didn't love their careers as much as what you would see. And I've always been a creative spirit. I joke that I'm a Gemini, so I'm both type A and very creative. So, like, I always had that creative itch that wasn't scratched. I think maybe the rest of my family didn't.
Okay, I love that you think that people in the 90s and presumably before just did jobs that they didn't like, and it's like a new
maybe
thing.
Maybe just the people
it's
I knew.
It's a new thing
I
to try
kind of it. Well, maybe it's, I don't know.
Leo, you and I are in an older generation. I think we would
That's we where would we're going to start?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the 80s anyway, too, not just the 90s. I'm not that
Anyway, Leo, tell us.
My name's
Leo. As an eminence on this stage.
A Gemini.
we've got some split personalities.
June, May. Okay, thanks. We have a lot to talk about. So yes, it's true. Ron Redziner and I started working together in 1989. And I say that all the time in our office, and so many people on our staff look at me and they say, that was before I was born. That always makes me feel great. We went to school together at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, and when we began, we started working together right down the street in Venice, and I moved to Venice after I finished school because I loved the community of Venice. I came to Los Angeles because of its architectural history. That's what brought me here. I grew up in Northern California, north of San Francisco in Marin County. So I defected from Northern California, moved here because of the traditions. I am to this day enamored with the modern tradition. There is so much to learn. There is so much relevance to the history of modern architecture here in LA. And so our practice has really been interested in that history. We've, of course, restored much of that history. And I think that for us, that's continuing education in the lessons of modern architecture, and to have to repair and uncover and take apart and put back together these artifacts, it's a great way to understand that thinking. So we're a unique office in that we are architects and began as traditional architects, but very quickly started doing construction. So we're a design build firm. And we also do landscape architecture and interior design. And because of the construction side of our office, we have a cabinet shop and a metal shop. Our construction teams include concrete teams. We have a finished carpentry team, landscape installation. We're a very unique mix of individuals. And it's one of the things I love the most about our office is that it's an incredibly diverse group of individuals with different perspectives and backgrounds, levels of experience, and we learn so much from all of them. So for me, it's a process of discovery. I think our projects, although fundamentally about so many of the lessons that we've learned here in Los Angeles, we're also trying to uncover and discover our clients' desires, the site's desire, and trying to respond to those influences. So I feel incredibly fortunate to have been in this industry for so long. thank you, Frances.
And you and I both.
Yes. And so with that, I will turn this over.
Hi, I'm Christine Vroom with Christine Vroom Interiors. My little LA story, I'm actually from the East Coast. We're from Boston and Jersey and on that side. And my little journey toward California was the LA dream that my parents had to kind of change your life, and we managed to kind of come this way. And so when I was within that time, when I was actually like a young little tween, my dad dated a woman, and she was an interior designer. And I was like, I am going to be her. So I looked up on AOL.com, and I was like, interior designer, that's what I want to be. So I went to design school straight out of high school. I went into graduated, started my design company when I was 21 years old. And I started with paint, picking pillows, picking fabric, and then just gradually sort of worked my way up. And now I do new luxury residential, and we've done hospitality. We do kind of everything in that realm. And I love LA, and I travel a lot, and I go to amazing countries and cities, and yet I still find myself coming back and being like, oh, I really just can't leave. So it might be the weather. I'm thinking it's the weather.
Well, the weather certainly helps, except San Diego down a few miles south has also great weather, but does it act as a function as a creative magnet in quite the same way? Indeed, many other very warm places. Sacramento actually has quite good weather, but I've never heard that being described as a creative capital. So I think there might be some other pieces to the story, but obviously the weather is a big attraction. And also the weather means you can do all, it expands your realm of creativity into the outdoors as well. So, okay, so you've all thrown out some very interesting points here. I just want to, I think, start actually with Leo, because Leo, you brought up something pretty fundamental, which is your admiration for the modern tradition. You've really staked out a particular arena of creativity in LA that you have found incredibly inspiring, which is the modern tradition. Now, the modern tradition was in itself inherently futuristic and experimental. In your view, was it able to flourish here because LA, there was something about LA that enabled that creativity? And where's architecture today? Does it follow in that same highly experimental tradition?
Sure. I mean, yeah, you're so correct. Inherent in the modern ideal is this embrace for technology and expansion. Los Angeles provided modern architects something truly unique in the world. It was beyond climate. Climate helped. But also, we had USC. USC was, at the time, after World War II, the educational institution that focused on modern design. We also had an industrial complex that was Hollywood and the aerospace industry. The aerospace industry was that technology that was leading edge and experimental. The Hollywood environment, it was more than just glamour. Glamour certainly added to it, but it was glamour that wanted to be seen. It wanted to make a visual statement. So it was a clientele that wanted to be exuberant. So you had a technology that was exuberant, clientele that was exuberant, and a climate that allowed you to kind of eviscerate the wall and truly live inside and outside. So it became this kind of experimental mix that was really amazing. And when we think about the modern LA tradition, we're talking about starting in the 1920s. With the King's Road House, Schindler's King's Road House, which is 1922, very early in the modern thinking. At that time, most of the work was happening in Europe and maybe some on the East Coast, but it started here early. So yes, Los Angeles provided a very unique incubator for modern thinking.
And is it still incubating modern thinking? And each of you can chime in on that one.
If there's anything we need today, it's this idea that less can somehow be made to be more. Sustainability, it's all about that, right? How do we make more experience out of less material? But more than that, we work in this culture of total overload, a social media driven world of anxiety and this kind of avalanche of visual stuff. And so modernism is about prioritizing. It's about taking a lot of that away and making choices about reducing our world. So if there's anything that's important today, and yes, I think it's just as vibrant. You see it in the design work that's happening here. And so I think it's as vital today as it was in the 20s.
Okay, again, you definitely espouse a very particular ethos. I mean, there's an argument for maximalism as much as there's an argument for minimalism, and LA does that pretty well.
He might actually argue with you if you do that. I mean, in terms of just LA as a whole, I mean, I was even driving through LA coming here, and we stumbled across a little neighborhood, and I'm like, I mean, I haven't been through here. You know, I think LA is such a, there's so many different demographics, so many different cultures within their own little pockets of LA, and I think they're all to be celebrated in that way. And I find, like we were talking about, inspiration and creativity, finding that in this area. And since we have so many of those different little pockets within this greater area, I find that there's so much inspiration to be had and so much inspiration yet to be discovered.
But I want to ask both of you, as interior designers, who both of you expressed that there was, like, you had this kind of flash. You saw something and you thought, I want to be an interior designer. And I'm wondering sort of a bit more about what that is, because back to Leo's point about modernism being developed in the 20s, at the same time, so too was glamour. Glamour was pretty much invented in Los Angeles as part of Hollywood. And part of that glamour story was people's interiors, dressing up very elegantly, posing in interiors, the interiors becoming showpieces for style and fashion and fantasy. And was it those things, those elements of interior design that sort of attracted you? And do you feel your clients are still encouraging you to be super expressive with your interiors? Or is this bombardment of images that Leo talks about, is the bombardment of images perhaps actually putting some limitations, you know, in terms of people perhaps being a little bit risk-averse?
The bombardment of images, it's something that we talk about at the office a lot, is kind of like a joke of, well, now with this whole social media and Instagram and the new ones and the TikToks and the whole thing, it's like we have to work so much harder to find something more unique. right? So we're trying to pull a little bit deeper. And also, I think there's this mentality right now of like, oh, well, I saw it. I can do it myself in a way. And so we really have to rise to an occasion that I think, you know, if you wanted a really nice house back in the day, you would just hire a designer because it wasn't really something that was natural. And now it almost feels natural because you're seeing it so much. So that's sort of my take on that.
I think what's actually stopped me from designing for so long or becoming a designer was I felt like it was an unattainable thing. I thought it was this thing that I joked that it was like rich old ladies just looking at fabrics, you know? And I thought it was something that regular people couldn't celebrate and experience. It is still a luxury service, don't get me wrong, but I do appreciate finding beauty kind of across all bounds. So whether it be bold, glamour, kind of all of that, but that's what I love about LA is like celebrating the diversity of it. Like you're saying, you can drive through a neighborhood and there's a totally different pocket that looks completely different from the next. And that's what I love about the whole Southern California area that you don't see in Texas at all, that I love to celebrate and just kind of playing in the sandbox with all of the design.
But let's talk about Texas. just to get you know, serious for a moment. A lot of people have left LA for Texas. You yourself said when you thought about having a family, it's like, well, I wouldn't do that in LA. Like, people used to have families in LA. Is that really that weird? So there's some and people are going to Texas, and indeed Asheville, North Carolina, and Raleigh, and all sorts of other cheaper areas, because LA has become really, really expensive to live in. And where it used to be possible to come here as a young, you know, wannabe designer and really get yourself quite a generous piece of square footage for an affordable price, you know, now you're lucky if you can get a micro studio, micro unit, 300 square feet for $1,500 a month. You know, it's really a different LA. And there's a lot of creativity going into trying to sort of solve that. But still, what does it mean for you, perhaps in your generation of designers that are coming up and sort of trying to make a go of it?
Yeah, I think for me with, it's true, I'm sort of going against the grain. Everybody came to Texas, and I would say 50% or more of my clients in the last 3 years have been from California. But what I love is like in Texas, and I can speak specifically to Austin since that's where I'm from, it's a young city, and I don't mean the ages of the people there. I mean, it has not been established the way what you're talking about, where after World War II, it was like, you know, this prestigious university that was teaching design, and it was a master class in design. We don't have that, and it shows in the architecture. It shows in what's available in the city, and it's very limiting from a creative standpoint, and people are very limited in their thought process about it. So that's what I do love about this whole social experiment in California. It's like you can do whatever, and there's something for everyone. So I do really appreciate that piece of it. I mean, the cost of living is very real, but it's everywhere. I mean, yes, it's bad in California, but it is, if you look at data, I'm going to totally screw up the actual data, but it was something like in the 80s, the average salary was $45,000 a year and the average home was $75,000 a year. And now it's like the average salary is $60,000 a year and the average home is $500,000. So it's become increasingly unaffordable for us to live anywhere unless we live in the sticks and, you know, work from home. But it's a real problem in the country as a whole, not just in Texas or California or whatever it is.
Leo, I'm getting the sense you want to say something.
I always want to say something. I mean, if we want to talk about the challenges, I think from an architectural perspective, it's twofold. It's not only a cost of living that's become really a burden on everyone except a small percentage. But second to that, we also work now in a bureaucratic environment that's become really a challenge to get anything done in an urban context. We have an approval process that is now nothing but obstructionist. It is difficult to achieve bad architecture, much less something that strives toward greatness. So Los Angeles is really at a crossroads. So it's more than just much of the country faces economic challenge. Los Angeles has made it so that regional planning is impossible because of NIMBY pockets of political strength now. And those NIMBY pockets now are fighting change. And that is the problem. As cities fight change, which is what so many of the community councils and kind of public-private organizations are doing, the moment a city stops changing is death for a city. We must change. We must adapt. We must continue to improve and grow. And without that perspective, there is no future for Los Angeles.
And yet, the ongoing paradox built into that, or contradiction, is that the really exciting and lovely houses of the 20s, 30s of 100 years ago that were produced in an atmosphere of change when LA was a young city, those are the very houses that now one wants to hold on to because they are such, they are so emblematic of their of architectural experimentation. And yet, the very fact of holding on to so much fabric also gets in the way of new change. So it's a kind of complicated situation that we're in right now, because can we get both? But Christine, how about you? As an interior designer, are you finding that you're getting even different kinds of commissions as we change our type of housing? So, for example, we do have the very small units that people are moving into. We now have penthouses in glass towers in downtown. We've got kind of a different type of housing that's appearing in greater and greater amounts. As an interior designer, do you have a different canvas to play on?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, because I'm in a little bubble in South Bay. I'm all over the Los Angeles area, but mostly pocketed from Palos Verdes to Manhattan Beach is where a lot of my work is. And so I find more that the range is within styles. So, you know, Spanish to this to that, and, you know, modern to all of these things. But there has been this, and maybe for you too, there has been this great influx in this ADU. Going on, mm-hmm. these ADUs, and so there's a lot of these like little baby houses in the backs of houses that now we're designing that are just as expensive as houses, but they're just smaller than a house size.
Like and bikini, so, like a bikini yeah. to a swimming swimsuit.
Yes, exactly. yeah, and so, but to your point about the challenges, I was thinking, they all of a sudden said, yes, let's go forward with the ADUs. And then all the changes started happening. And then there was like a halt on the ADUs. So there's kind of like, for me, I'm not doing like Airstreams or, you know, like little tiny, what are those new popular things? Those like little storage box houses or something like that.
Oh, you mean shipping containers.
Yes, shipping container house. Not in that department. But... yeah, I find it more within like a style range, you know, restoring an old Tudor and then doing a Spanish Revival and then doing a modern Georgian and then doing, so there's a lot of that range going on for me.
Got it. What about you, Sarah?
Same with the ADU piece of it. That's like a new world where we're doing a ton of those. I did probably about 4 or 5 years ago, I worked on the first 3D printed house that was printed in Austin, and it was the first first permitted 3D printed home. And the idea behind it was going to make the cost of living more affordable. We were going to be able to throw up homes for $10,000 in a week. And I find it a little gimmicky, to be honest, but it's a really interesting way that technology is going with home building and design that I think that there's something there that can help solve a little bit of the housing crisis. I do think there is a need for, and people are wanting more smaller living. I mean, myself moving from Texas, I moved from a 4,000 square foot home to a 2,000 square foot home, and I've never been happier because, God, it was a lot of space to take care of, and I think a lot of people are just a little tired of living in these big, vast homes that they don't use most of, and they're more aware of their usage as well, so sustainability kind of comes into play there. They don't want a bunch of empty rooms that just kind of sit there air-conditioned.
Gathering dust.
Correct. Unused.
There's another piece to LA creativity that has to do with, I guess, goes beyond style. It's sort of materials and a fabrication. And LA, you know, dating starting from the 1920s, but I think possibly coming to a height after the Second World War, really had a complete design industry. Materials were made here, ideas were tested here. Magazines were produced, Shelter magazines that were produced, Sunset magazine that promulgated LA design. Photographers were here. There was a whole kind of California living story, and it was expressed in every dimension. Do we still have that? Or with this bombardment of images that you've talked about, which increases people's expectations of all this stuff they see online, and much of the imagery comes from all over the place, international cities, countries, what have you. Do we have a sort of specific LA voice right now?
I think so. I actually just had a conversation with my Kravit rep, who's amazing, but I had a conversation because she came in with a bunch of glittery fabrics, and I'm like, what is this? Like, what? why are there metallic threads in all of the fabrics? And so we laughed, and then I got on, she videoed me, and I said, Mr. Kravit, LA needs some linen in your spread. And so we're just kind of joking about, you know, that. But I think because New York is so big, and there's this whole like Florida world, you know, that they are really big in textiles. And I feel like this California casual kind of more relaxed world, even in modern and even in all styles, is kind of coming through. And so I definitely feel that from an interior perspective, that it's just a little bit like stronger than the New York voice for me right now.
Huh, but what are the materials? Did you say linen? Is it?
I feel like with textiles, like with and materials, you know, we're doing a lot of like performance-based stuff. So there's a lot of, you know, high double rubs, and there's a lot of, you know, Krypton backed, and a lot of, you know, washable, bleachables, all of those things. And then, but also not just that old like scratchy version, there's the linen-y version, the boucle version of that, the silky version of that. So I think we're just getting more innovative with how to achieve these more like beautiful, luxurious textiles and materials, but yet still getting that technology behind it.
And are they fabricated here in LA? And is it LA-based designers of fabrics and textiles?
Some of them. I do see a lot of like LA printed. We talked about that too. I remember LA printed prints on linen. I feel like that's a huge thing. And I get a lot of boutique companies coming into the studio and seeing their line. And we love supporting small businesses. That's kind of a big like, you know, heartbeat of my company, is just trying to support other small businesses. And so I find that those factories are starting to get a little bit bigger. Wall coverings is like that, and furnishings. So I'm seeing a lot of that.
Sarah?
Yeah, I think the California casual approach is definitely something we get asked for a lot. Maybe not in those words verbatim, but if we're talking about the thing that Josh says we're not allowed to talk about that happened 4 years ago, after COVID, you know, life had to be more comfortable and livable at home. And so that showed in the textiles and the pieces. I mean, even looking at this, you would never have seen a set like this in 2019. It would have looked completely different.
Really? What would it have looked like?
It would have been much more, in my opinion, it would have been much more rigid. There would have been darker. It would have been less single note in tone, less of touchability in the textiles. I mean, there's a big, you know, boucle became big after COVID for a reason. There's a lot of studies about it. It's like people were craving touch. And so now we are very much a culture, or we always were a culture, but we were very much more hyper aware of needing to touch and feel and have those layers, because we didn't have touch for a whole year of our lives. So the psychology behind that's very interesting. But I think coming through with that, it appears as that California casual, less dressed up, you know, more casual version, and less formality in life in general, just because you have to actually live in your home. You can't just look at it.
Right, right. And what about extending outdoors? Because obviously part of the COVID experience was trying to have your little piece of outdoors. And so has that also expressed itself in furnishings and materials?
Oh, I definitely think so. And it's more of the indoor-outdoor in the sense that if you open up the doors, it could feel like it's another room of the house. It doesn't necessarily feel like an entirely separate space.
Right. Leo, your firm has specialized in materiality. So probably you're thinking, this is not new, tactility?
Well, I think for us, there's always been an interest in natural materials and the texture and tone of natural materials as opposed to more fabricated, industrialized products. But I think media really does have a lot to do with this. And Los Angeles had, during the modern kind of heyday, had Arts and Architecture magazine and John Intenza's mission to push modern design out into the universe. Sunset Magazine was in San Francisco, a very different design climate. So here we not only had Arts and Architecture, we also had Julia Shulman. So these masters of media manipulation. Today the media culture is much more complicated, much more informal. There aren't the kind of tomes that you have to read every month. Now there's a myriad of different ways in which we absorb media. But media now is pushing a much more casual kind of environment, maybe as a response to the pandemic that we lived through, maybe just as a response to its kind of the way in which media is now absorbed by all of us. But you feel a more casual quality. I will say, I enjoy it. It's not my nature. I tend to be much more uptight and rigid than that, and really miss the kind of discipline of so much of that. Yes.
You need to get some boucle in your life, Leo.
I do. There's so much I need in my life. But and I crave touch even before the pandemic. It's not, yeah, exactly. It's just that I think we are looking to be informed very differently, and that does have an impact on what we want and how we want it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I do think it's interesting, this issue of this bombardment of imagery, because it really is possible to be distracted by TikTok for hours on end, you know? Actually, I don't go on TikTok, but I know that theoretically it is possible to be distracted for hours. And the reason why I don't go, because I know I would be distracted, so I avoid it in order to focus. Focus is an issue. You know, even I've had conversations with some of the, I guess, older, you know, dare I say, older people like, say...
Why do you keep bringing that up?
I feel like I'm getting, like, silently roasted for just saying the 90s.
I'm going to say, you know, quite senior people, such as, say, the architect Frank Gehry, who's in his 90s, who did go to USC when it was having its heyday, who was getting started in the 1950s before he became the famous Gehry that we're all familiar with now. And he has talked about how freeing it felt at that time for him and many of his artist friends, who were just quietly working away in their studios. Nobody was taking any notice. The East Coast was not interested, thought LA, despite Arts and Architecture, nonetheless, generally, LA was seen as a backwater, and the backwater was a help, not a hindrance. It was freeing. Now, LA is not a backwater at all. It is absolutely a global destination, especially for people in the creative industries. Does it become a challenge to stay focused on your work and find your own voice in all that noise?
Okay, I just went on a... Go,
no,
do you want to
go?
I just went on a rant last night about how I can't focus. Actually, it's not that I can't focus, it's that there's too many distractions. And I was like, I need to figure out a new system, you know? And so I was really, it's kind of a common theme for me in the past several months. And it's just like, the emails, how many emails am I gonna write a day? How many emails? I write the emails and then the more come. And then, you know, I'm working in the office and people are coming in. And although I love that and I'm very community-based, I'm also like, what are you doing here? I'm trying to work. And so I find myself, and then it's like, oh, an Instagram thing pops up, and then there's text messages, and there's text, and it's just like, you're just like, wow, I got nothing done, and I've spent 8 hours sitting at my desk. And I hope clients aren't listening because that really doesn't happen. I do get work done. But I just mean in terms of I get a lot of work done, but I just find myself very, very pulled in so many directions currently. And maybe it's just a season of my personal life. Maybe it is just like we've been talking about, this influx of just like so much imaging, so much conversations, so much talking, so many emails, so much media. And so I don't have a solution at the moment, but I am finding that there is a need to kind of take a step back and just like kind of quiet my mind and quiet my space and almost create a new environment to work in a way, or a new process, so that I can get in my creative mode.
Interesting. Sarah?
Well, if my clients are listening, I work all the time. I never stop working. I don't sleep, and I don't eat, and I just keep working. But, similarly, yeah, there's a lot of distractions out there. I kind of, like, love the bombardment of information just because I feel like I get to experience and see so much I wouldn't normally if I just stayed sort of in my silo. But I agree it's hard to focus. When it comes to creating my own voice or my own, you know, aesthetic or look, when it comes to clients and them showing me images, where we get stuck often is, say, we'll look at an inspiration photo of a bathroom, and they'll go, great, I love this look. Okay, well, let me design something sort of in the same vibe, but, you know, with my stamp on it and what you need. And then say, yeah, but, like, look at that tile. I really like that tile from that image. Why don't we just do that picture? And so it's a lot of educating them, like, that's not just what we're here for. We're not just implementers of someone else's design. That's where the bombardment of images gets us. They're like, it's not quite right. Hold on, let me get on Pinterest real quick, and I can show you what I'm saying, what I'm trying to describe that I like. So that's where it's our detriment, I think. I like it because it keeps me creative, but I do think that's where I start to step on toes.
I do have a very quick, funny story about that because, and I already told Sarah we've bumped into each other in New York, but I had a client and she's like, I love this bathroom. And I was like, oh, me too. And so she was, basically that entire episode happened where I was like, okay, here's the vibe of that. And she's like, I actually just want that tile. And I'm like, all right, we'll just do the tile. And then it was like, we're doing the same exact finish. We're doing the same whole thing. And it's Sarah's design. It's Sarah, a house that Sarah designed. So anyway, I told her the story.
Because I was like, you stole my design.
I was like, I hope you don't mind, but I'm totally copying this bathroom, unfortunately.
Whereas I was like, if you had called me, I would have given you all the list of sources.
That would have been so much better.
That's a very good story. Leo?
I see similar projects to our work all the time out there in the world. I think the process of design is a process of selection. And as designers, we are cutting things away and focusing our efforts on particular choices. And we're just trained to make choices in our world. I find the myriad of choice both invigorating and overwhelming. And I think we're all just grappling with that. And I happen to have two teenage children. And I think parents are really trying to grapple with that abundance of information, much of it good, much of it beyond tragic, especially for our children. Fortunately, Meta is now being sued by every state in the nation. I think the joy is that we have better visibility on more things. And I think as designers, that's really positive and invigorating.
As the mother of a teenage girl, I definitely hear you about the dark side of the web.
I have a teenage dog.
Does that count? Oh my gosh.
Have you banned your dog from being on Facebook?
Do you know that could be a whole other
conversation? He's not allowed on Facebook and Instagram.
But the creativity in the pet direction, I mean, that is something that is of our time. The level of creativity, creative energy that's going into making a dog's life the best life ever. But in a couple of minutes, we're going to throw it over to you for questions, but I do want you three all to ask me this one question, which is, in terms of sort of something really creative that's going on in LA that just has caught your attention, what might it be? Is there something going on in technology or in materials or in style that just feels fresh and new?
I sort of love the I'm not a big fashion gal, but I do sort of love the celebration of mixing both casual and formal, kind of going to that glamour piece of it. Like, I mean, I'm wearing sneakers today, but that, you know, you could wear like high-end polished sneakers, be comfortable. And I sort of love that LA has embraced the California casual with the glamour and sort of merged the two.
Okay, interesting. Leo?
I think architecturally, it's a recognition of the importance of communal living. So I think Los Angeles, you're seeing an explosion of apartment and multifamily work and this acceptance that the single family home is not only unsustainable and bad for our planet, it's actually not even the best way to participate with each other in an urban context. I completely give credit to Francis's book on apartments. It's only because of Francis's book. Okay, maybe there's more. But I think the emergence and recognition that communal living is in fact positive and not a secondary class of living, but in fact should be and can be our primary choice for living.
Well, Leo, I had no idea you were going to plug my book, which happens to be sitting in my bag on the front row. It's called Common Ground, Multifamily Housing in Los Angeles. Thank you. And with that, Christine.
Yeah, what I'm finding inspiring right now is, I know I'm a little contradicted where I was talking about this California casual, but I'm loving how many, like we're taking, I feel like the historic is coming back, whether it be in color palette, whether it be in molding buildups, whether it be and even, you know, in the various styles, not necessarily like historic design, but just little things based on history are kind of coming back. And I'm finding that a breath of fresh air for me.
All great answers. Okay, over to you all. Josh, you've got a microphone. Yeah, so if we have questions, Josh will come to you with a mic. Here we go, question over here. Oh, Josh?
Oh, okay. Hi, okay? Great panel. I'm Sakshi. So my question is that when you guys are dealing with clients, so when you're picking out products, do you prefer to take the client with you while shopping for products, or do you prefer to do it on your own? How do you go about it? Because I know everybody has a preference. What's your take on that?
No, I don't like to go anywhere with my clients.
Why not?
I really don't. Because they're hiring me for a job. So part of my job is my expertise. And I spend a lot of time traveling around, whether it be locally or around the world, to touch and feel and see. And I'm bringing to them what I deem to be the best solutions for their projects. So me taking them to a showroom is just going to open up a can of worms and a world of problems.
Same. Maybe a less harsh way. Just kidding.
I don't go anywhere with them.
No, it really depends. I actually read the client. I have to read them. Like, do I feel like they could handle being in a very overwhelming environment? And I also just don't go and like, oh, what do you like? I mean, it's like I've done a bunch of work. I have a presentation ready. I'm willing to maybe do it at maybe like a tile shop or something because it's easier to pull stuff off. But less... less than more times I not, yeah.
But to your story about the tile, the way your client wouldn't budge and had to have Sarah's tile, could you in that moment have said, hey, let's go down to Ann Sachs or whatever it is. Let's go down to the tile store and I will show you five tiles that...
I usually just go find like five tiles and bring them.
Okay.
But like I really try to limit extra anxiety that they might have.
I have found that the clients that want that are the ones that are looking to hire a new best friend, and I'm not looking for new best friends, so I say no.
Leo, do you go out on little...
I don't even like to go shopping, much less take anyone with me. And it's not my role in the office anyway. But I think that you know, client issues are part of what we do. I mean, we serve clients. That's our job. And I will say it's a challenge because you're trying to understand them. You of course come with a voice. So we hope that they are coming to you because of respect for that voice and they want to hear it. The strange thing is, even where we sit, often clients come to us and they're not even interested in our voice. And I wonder why they're paying us. But it does happen. It's
to validate
it's
them.
Rare. Yeah, it happens less today than it did, you know, 30 years ago. But I think it again, we're trying to limit choices, and unfortunately, often clients are seeing a barrage of choice, and we're just trying to keep them focused.
I have just one quick thing to add to, just because I started my company so young, and there's so much learning involved in that, you know, raising your prices and there's all these little steps that you take. And I found that part of bringing clients with me was almost like a security blanket. Like, well, that way I can't really get it wrong. And so then I just had to really build up my own confidence. It's like, no, these are three, done, you know? And so that was just something for me that helped me is realizing, like Sarah saying, I'm the expert, I'm well-trained, I know exactly what I'm doing. I love my job every single day. I'm very confident in the decisions that I'm making, and then they'll feel that.
That's interesting. Any other questions? Here's a question.
With most of the prices of homes in Los Angeles being over $500,000, do you think there are more opportunities for designers to come in because it is worth the investment, or do you think that the threshold for designers to come in on a project has just been raised to a higher price range?
Who wants to? Good question.
I don't. I think that there's work for all, and I think that there's plenty of room in the sandbox. It never ends, in my opinion.
I think it's a great question, and it points out one of the fundamental problems we have culturally is that fewer and fewer people are available to hire us as architects and designers, that our client base is shrinking every day, which bodes poorly for our future, that the wealthy continue to have more strength financially, but the gap between that and the majority of other people, cannot hire us. That was very different than Richard Neutra and Schindler and Lautner were practicing. Neutra was building houses for middle-class people at $8 a square foot. Now, he was also designing the Kaufman House at over $100 a square foot, and Edgar Kaufman was in that rarefied 1%. But the majority of Richard Neutra's homes were for the middle class. You don't see that today, and that is a problem for, I think, because I believe in design, I think it's a problem when fewer and fewer people can truly tap into it. Maybe they can through social media and kind of fake it on their own. Great. But in terms of hiring professionals, fewer and fewer people are capable financially of hiring professionals, and that is not good for us as a community.
Although, Leo, to that point, that's very interesting that you raise that, and it's a really interesting question. I mean, I think back to, say, middle-class Los Angeles, when there really was, you know, home building for the middle classes. And a lot of those homeowners, they certainly didn't hire an interior designer, but they might get fill their interiors with furnishings bought from, say, Barker Brothers. Now, Barker Brothers might have in-house designers. And I'm thinking today, what would be the analogy today? So the young person that moves into one of these studios might go to, say, they might go to IKEA and fill it up with IKEA furniture. But is there a team of interior designers, people from the design industry who are just working in a different corner of the industry, perhaps in-house for a big company? I mean, is that part of the equation here that it's kind of reached the same creative skills are just finding a different place to be employed?
Well, most of the big furniture houses do have design support, whether it's RH or or BR, all of them. They have
IKEA's even launching.
IKEA,
it. Yeah.
They have in-house design. And so, yeah, maybe that's the answer, is that it's being provided by those that are not making their money through the design, but making their money through the sale of product.
Right.
And maybe that's where we can more democratize the availability of design.
Did you want to add to that? No. Time. Oh, one more. Another question.
Hi, thank you. This is just kind of dovetailing on all the things that we were talking about, talking around that affordability issue and design, interior design and architecture as a luxury service. And the fact that we are in a situation where you do really have these like great income in disparities, so that becomes like available to fewer and fewer people. And I love what you were talking about, the multifamily, and making that aspirational. And this is not so much a question as just an encouragement to really think about those multifamily, you know, how can you create aspirational design in the multifamily space so that it does not seem like it is either a second best choice that somebody is making because they can't afford the single family home. I definitely think that we do need to move more in that direction, at least when you're talking about in a city, so that there is more accessibility for all of the people who at this point can't really afford that single family. And it is, like you said, it's better for us as a community to be living in community as opposed to our own little bubbles. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I thank you, and certainly I agree. I mean, we just finished an 86-story tower downtown, and we're really excited about it. And one thing that I think is helping with making those living experiences more sought after is the investment by the developers in the communal space, in the public spaces, in the amenities. And it's beyond just an exercise room now, a gym. It's a gym, but it's a communal gathering space. There are outdoor spaces. There's community barbecue areas. There's dog park walking areas. There's dog salons. There's all kinds of things that make that communal living really vital, where you can meet your neighbors on a social basis, and that I think is really positive.
And just to add to that point, so again, I wrote a book called Common Ground, Multifamily Housing.
It's a very good book.
But the book tries to do something that has not been done in Southern California for many years, which is basically make multifamily housing alluring and appealing and sexy. And I know someone that used to work at Sunset Magazine, and she said they literally had an editorial policy of no apartments. We do not do stories on apartments. And that sends a very strong cultural message. So to get back to our theme of, or one of our themes of this panel before we close, has been this one of the storytelling. You know, and so part of design is how you tell the story about design, and that, I think, is part of the shift that's going on right now as well. And with that, so thank you so much, all of you, for being here, and Josh Cooperman for putting together this panel, and Sarah, Christine, and Leo.